Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Content warning. Take care while listening to this podcast. It discusses criminal activity, including substance use, violence, and murder. Interviews conducted for this podcast do not reflect the views of the host, of EarCult LLC, or its partners. Listener discretion is advised.
If you can just keep believing when nothing in you is working, when all your external forces have given way, if you can just manage to somehow keep hoping, just hope. You ain't even really got to believe. All you got to do is hope. Just go to bed and just wake up tomorrow. Every time you wake up, that's a sign from God that he ain't through with you yet. See, that right there. As long as you waking up, he's saying to you, I ain't through with you yet.
Wednesday, November 5th, 1986. Port Huron, Michigan. A cold, unremarkable morning. 20-year-old Scott Macklem drove a class at St. Clair County Community College, known locally as SC4. He never made it home. Scott was murdered in the campus parking lot by an unknown gunman, leaving this quiet port town on the Canadian border shaken and desperate for answers. The police quickly zeroed in on one man, Fred Freeman, now known as Temujin Kinsu. But there were glaring issues. Temujin had alibis placing him over 400 miles away at the moment the murder occurred. The trial that followed was rife with controversy, marked by shaky evidence, questionable testimony, and a conviction so unbelievable it raised more questions than answers. Now, we're taking you inside a real-time investigation of this story, featuring new revelations from witnesses, expert insights from those who studied the case, and a meticulous re-examination of the trial, the evidence, and the events that brought us here. I'm the last person you would expect to do this. I've spent most of my podcasting career telling stories of how law enforcement and the justice system got it right. But in this case, I believe they got it wrong. Now, I'm here, and the goal is simple. Uncover the truth and seek justice, not just for Temujin Kinsu, but also for Scott Macklem. 2 life sentences, 1 search for the truth. I'm Jason Ussery. And this is Inconceivable, the story of Temujin Kinsu. Chapter 1, Who Was Fred Freeman? Part 1. Hope. Steve Harvey explains the concept in one of his famous semi-sermons on the set of Family Feud. He discusses faith. He discusses God. And as a counter to that, he talks about hopelessness. In my favorite film, The Shawshank Redemption, the character Red, played by Morgan Freeman, tries to tell Andy Dufresne, played by Tim Robbins, about the peril of hope inside a prison.
I need it so you don't forget.
Forget?
Forget that there are places in the world that aren't made out of stone, that there's something inside that they can't get to, that they can't touch. It's yours.
What are you talking about?
Hope.
Hope. Let me tell you something, my friend. Hope is a dangerous thing. Hope can drive a man insane. It's got no use on the inside. I better get used to that idea.
It's hard not to feel that way now. I'm surrounded by walls, fences, razor wire. Everything precisely designed to keep those imprisoned exactly where they are. Most of them went in unwillingly, even if most of them deserved it. But here I am, walking in on my own accord. I admit, it does feel hopeless. All I'm able to offer is to tell the story of Scott Macklin's murder and of MDOC prisoner number 189355's incarceration. All I have to give are the words I write and the voice I project. I suppose that is all of us. I think about the concept of hope as I ready myself to speak to Temujin in person for the first time. My mind begs the question, if someone is actually innocent, yet they have spent decades behind bars with no hope for freedom, how do they feel it? Express it? How do they even wake up and face their day in a place like this? I don't know how he does it, but every time I speak to Temujin, he overflows with hope. As I walk toward the administration building, I pass a news vehicle. There is snow and ice all around me. It's January. Lacombe Correctional rests on about 100 acres just outside of Lenox Township, Michigan. It is situated right next to the Oak Ridge Golf Club. The facility is made up of 13 total buildings, equaling approximately 300,000 square feet. The inmate population here is males aged 18 and older, and max capacity is just a little over 1,400. As I mentioned, there are the regular things you'd expect to see at a prison. Corrections officers, razor wire, the brick, the fences, and the walls. If these were the only walls I had to confront in this case, it might be a piece of cake. Unfortunately, there are so many more. A single mistake or misstep will get me painted one way or another, when all I really want to do is figure out what happened that day to Scott Macklem and why the man I'm about to interview was convicted of the crime. So, to do that, I figured we'd start at the beginning and ask a couple of four-word questions. Questions that have very complicated answers. Who was Fred Freeman? And who is Temujin Kinsu? Remember, for my official on-site interview, I'm unable to take in a recording device. I'm allowed to bring in a notepad and a couple of pens. Recall also that I have a workaround for that. Joy Marie Mann, who is the author of My Friend Temujin, Serving Life-Changing Lives, and I made a deal. The state previously agreed to let Joy take a recording device into her interview, which is the one to follow mine. Since she didn't have one, we struck an agreement. I would allow her to use the transcript from her interview for her book, and I would use the audio for my podcast. That's not all the audio I have, however. For these episodes, I have previously recorded conversations with Temujin and observations from the 20 or so pages of notes I took in my two-hour visit with him. For the next few episodes, I will pose that question. Who was Fred Freeman? You will hear the answer directly from him, so you can choose to believe him or not. What I can say is that I think you'll hear from Temujin in a way that perhaps you never have before. But before we get to that, I do want to briefly outline the process of getting into the prison to visit with him, in case you ever become crazy enough to want to do something like this yourself. I got a hell of a runaround from the MDOC when I went to set up this interview. As a matter of fact, this interview was supposed to be conducted in October. I was blocked. Everyone was blocked. I won't share all the details here now. Maybe I'll do that in a Patreon bonus. But suffice it to say, it was a pain.
Hi, Ms. Golson. This is Jason Usry. I'm a journalist out of Savannah, Georgia. I was hoping to get some media time with one of your prisoners and wanted to see how I might be able to do that.
Okay. I'm going to direct you to send an email to our public information officer.
Okay.
And she can provide me with information as to whether to move forward with scheduling or not.
Okay. Are there any restrictions to scheduling in particular that might hold me back?
I'm going to defer you to her, and you can ask her those questions.
Okie dokie. Thank you so much.
Okay.
But
did you want
now
her
I'm
number?
Here.
I mean, her email?
Yes, that'd be
great. And I've just entered the administration building. I approach the front desk to check in. Initially, I'm either not noticed or not acknowledged. Maybe I'm a ninja too. After I'm able to get the attention of the officer handling check-in, he's cordial. I tell him I'm there to speak with Temujin Kinsu and sign in. Another nearby officer makes a joke that today must be media day. I respond that he has no idea. There will be others. After signing in and handing over my ID, I'm directed to take a seat while I await my turn. A news reporter from the Upper Peninsula I met the last time I was in Michigan got the first slot of the day. Unfortunately, she only requested 30 minutes, so her time was exceedingly short. We spoke later that night about her experience, and hopefully she'll share it with us. While I wait, I decide, since I have a 2-hour slot, to go to the restroom. I walk in, and I have to tell you, it was an absolute mess. Used toilet paper rolls on the floor, an empty water bottle, the sink, ceiling, stall walls were all filthy. It is pretty disgusting. Hopefully they hear this and hire a cleaning company. But it's a real eye-opener. If this is what you show to the public, what are the living conditions like on the inside? If it's as bad as it is out here, how can someone have as much hope as Temujin Kinsu? As the clock ticks down to my allotted interview time, my heart rate increases. While excited about the visit, I know there are tough things that I have to ask Temujin. Things that are shameful and embarrassing. I've communicated this to him before, and he has never been afraid, nor has he shied away. He has only told me that he trusts that I will tell the truth, and that's what I plan to do. But it's hard sitting across from someone and asking them ugly things about their past. If I thought it wouldn't help us get closer to the truth, I probably wouldn't do it. I see movement behind the security door and a friendly face emerges. I grab my notepad, stand, and move toward the secure area. The friendly face that I see is that of Grace Blair of TV6 and Fox UP in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Back in October, when we were investigating Rock and Escanaba, where Temujin had his alibis, I was invited by Jim McNeil of Delta Force PI to his office. He'd recently heard about the case from Herb Welzer, a retired Port Huron police detective who has worked as a private investigator on this case for decades.
In terms of getting him out immediately or quickly.
I know this is a lot of names, and, well, buckle up, because there are a whole lot more. But I'm going to do my best to help you get to know all of them in due time. Grace interviewed Jim and his co-owner, Molly Barron, for a story on Temujin's case, in hopes that her story would prod the memories of additional witnesses up north. You should check out her reporting. Here's a snippet with credit to Grace and her television station, TV6 and Fox UP.
Today marks 38 years since a Michigan man was arrested as a suspect for murder. 37 years ago, he was sentenced to life in prison without parole. But he says he was 450 miles away from the crime when it happened.
When Grace sees me, she smiles and waves. She's accompanied by Jenny Reilly, who is the public information officer of the Michigan Department of Corrections, and Mona Golson, the administrative assistant to Warden Jeff Tanner. They wave me forward. They are polite and usher me into a small security screening room. Inside, there is one officer, and in front of me is a guard station with two corrections officers inside. In that security room is a metal detector. The security officer searches my notepad and pens. I wonder if they think I'm hiding something in it like Andy Dufresne. I'm not. I walk through the metal detector, and thankfully, there are no sounds or flashing lights. Ms. Golson then hands me a small black device with a red button. She says to me, "If you feel threatened at any time, push the red button." But with all the chaos and my mind racing, all I heard was push the red button, and then I started to do it. She immediately stopped me and said, "No, no, no, this is a panic button. Only push it if you feel threatened." Ms. Reilly then asks me if I'm comfortable going in on my own with him. I tell her, "Absolutely. I'll be fine." After a lot of buzzes and holdups, they open the door. And there he is. He's about my height. Long hair. Unshaven. In a prison-issued blue shirt and pants. When I first see him, he's about 25 feet away. It was odd seeing him in person for the first time. At this point, I'd only seen him in Paula's pictures or reports in the media. He's standing in a resting karate position, and there is no emotion on his face. There's not the smile I thought I'd be greeted with. It's stark, and it's strange, and it's so not like him. Frankly, I think the room has a double-sided mirror. I'm led to the door, they open it, and I find that his expressionless demeanor is not for me, but for Mona Golson and Jenny Reilly. He tells them he wants to get me lunch or coffee. Ms. Golson tells him no. As far as I witnessed, this was the only time he got upset. He had previously told me that when I came, he wanted to buy me lunch. He made some apologies of what that lunch would be. He was upset he wasn't able to buy that lunch for me. And though I appreciated the gesture, I'm not here for lunch. We settle in and engage in some small talk. He asks about my little ninja. He knows my son studies martial arts, and he has been a great mentor in that pursuit. You'll actually hear from the little ninja in a later episode. As our small talk wanes, I push to get into the actual interview. I only have a couple of hours, and we've used up a few minutes to discuss the smaller things. My interview strategy, which I ran by retired FBI profiler Julia Cowley of the podcast, The Consult Real FBI Profilers, is different than most interviews I've heard conducted with him. Like I said, I want to know who Fred Freeman was and who Temujin Kinsu is. There are those walls again. I need a way to break them down. My questions today are largely not things found in the trial transcripts or reports. So I tell Temujin, I want to start this interview differently. He says okay. Then I tell him, I want to pray with him. He seems genuinely shocked, but in a good way. He says he didn't realize that I was a man of faith, and that it was a great comfort to him that I am. He pulls a Celtic cross from beneath his shirt and lets it fall in front of him as he bows his head. I close my eyes, and at first I pray for Scott and his family. Then I pray for Temujin, Paula, and finally that justice be granted to both men and their loved ones.
Here in America, work is in trouble. We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is a company that's pushing back against this tide. They make high-quality clothing, sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. Visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com. Promo code STAPLE20.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Yeah, you know, he's born in Albany, Georgia, which is right. I live most of my life in Cairo, which is about 40 minutes from Albany.
As most of our conversations begin, we start in a random place and move to more relevant topics. Here, we start with Ray Charles and move into his stepdad. Like many of Temujin's relationships, it seems complicated.
My gigantic war veteran loved Ray Charles.
Really? That's Gerald, right?
See this guy who I never... This is my stepdad, Gerald, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Huge, 6'5", 330 pounds, with a 32-inch waist. He looked like a Viking.
Yeah.
He had a huge red beard, red wavy hair. He looked like he was going to kill you for looking at him wrong.
Right.
But he really wasn't that bad of a guy. He loved Ray Charles. And he would sit around listening to Ray Charles, and it would always kind of surprise me. Because he was, you know, your all-American war veteran, deer rifle, Campbell cigarette-smoking, sausage and steak-eating American. But yeah, so
these recordings come from a few different sources. Some from Joy Marie Mann's interview with Temujin. Some from phone conversations I've had with him. Some will be me recounting his answers and behavior from my notes. As such, this is lightly edited to stay on topic, but no substantive information has been removed.
But yeah, so I grew up listening to all the old Ray Charles songs, so I love Ray Charles.
That's awesome. And he's the one that, he had the Harley, right?
Yeah, he had the Harley, right. Yep. Oh, good memory. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he's the Harley. He still has a couple of them now down in Florida.
Right.
He's got a place down in Florida, and he's got a chopper. And he's got a chopper, he's got a big cruiser.
Have you talked to him?
Not since 1983.
Was that whenever you went with the girlfriend?
Yeah, Shelly. Yeah, different honey, a different Shelly.
Got it.
Shelly. Yeah, you have a very good memory, my friend. That's right. Yeah, I went and saw him, and we had a really nice friendly visit. But remember, right after that, I went to Washington State.
Right.
And then I came back in '85, and obviously got arrested in '86, so I never saw him again after that.
Temujin is talking about his arrest on the bad check charge from Washington State. We'll get there, but I want to get through his childhood first.
And as far as talking goes, him and my mom split up, so I don't even have his phone number. But he has some stuff online. Actually, there's some pictures of him now on my sister's page. She has a very tiny little page, and there's a couple photos of him. But when I was talking to her in the 2000s, she told me about his getting bought out by GM. They gave him a very generous buyout. Mm-hmm. Crazy, like $154,000 and a brand new vehicle and early retirement. Because, you know, those GM guys here in Michigan, they were under the old UAW contracts.
Yeah.
They were making like $33 an hour in the 70s. They were making insane money.
Yeah.
In Michigan, the shop guys, they all had every toy. You know, they all had a boat, they all had a camper, they all had a motorcycle, you know, they all had a truck. They had, like, every toy you could buy.
What's his last name?
He had 4 tours in Nam, and most of those guys were really young in Nam.
August 1945 is when he was born.
There you go. Yep. Okay.
I'll try to reach out to him, maybe.
I don't have the band, but, yeah, no, you don't want to do that.
Why?
No. You do not want to do that. No, he is not that kind of guy. He will hang up on you.
That's okay. I'm used to that.
No, this is a very mean man. We are not friends, and there is no love lost between us.
Oh, I thought that you loved him. I won't reach out to him then.
No, we hated each other. No, that's why I was so surprised about that little thing in '83 where he actually had me come over the house and, you know, here. No, he hated me. Yeah. No, we have no memories, no friendship. He never taught me a single thing. He never took me anywhere. No, we were not buds. We were the burden he accepted when he married my mom. And he made that very clear. So he took no part in our raising. He never took us anywhere. Never taught us anything. Barely spoke to us. He grew up in a Polish immigrant family of 11 brothers and sisters. Both my aunts are nuns. My Aunt Teresa and Aunt Marion are nuns. In fact, one of them in that photo there on Jenny's site, you can see she's wearing nun's clothing. That's Aunt Marion. They're both Catholic. They're Roman Polish Catholic immigrants. His father was Alawite, and they grew up in a home where you did not speak ever. And he believed that's how it was supposed to be in our home. And when we would go over there for holidays, it was a nightmare. It sit there, shut up, don't move, don't go anywhere. I'm a little kid. Don't play. There's no toys. Just sit in a chair and don't move for 6 hours, unless you got to use the bathroom. You ask permission to get up, you go back, sit in the chair, and you don't move. It was horrible. Horrible, horrible youth. My mom beat me into a coma. He knew about it. He did nothing about it. Because in his mind, that was not his kid.
Well, let's talk about that. That's one of the reasons I wanted to call. Yeah. I wanted to get some things just about your... Because I have notes, and then I know...
Okay.
Joy asked some questions, but I wanted to get a couple things. There are a couple things that really struck me when we talked.
Yeah.
That it's better, you know, as I'm putting the episode together, like I really want you to tell the stories. So talk about your mom. Talk about, I've got when she, with the story with the doctors, when they said you were gifted and then she said that you'd fool.
Yeah.
I don't need that one. Like
Dr. Stanley Eisen. E-I-S-E-N.
Since I bring this up now, I'll go ahead and play that clip from Joy's interview on January 16th at Macomb Correctional. Fair note here. Some audio is easier to understand than others.
Mom really went out of her way to keep me from progressing with the studies and with the advanced learning programs that some of my teachers tried to get me into after the determination that I was some kind of a superhuman mega genius, which I still find comical. But definitely, I was definitely quicker than the other kids. So what they used to do with me was they would put me in my own little programs. So they used to have a thing called the SRA, Scholastic Reading Association programs. And like they ran me through 3 years of it in like 3 months. And then I'm in class with nothing to do. And they're calling my mom going, let us just bump the kid up, you know. Well, no, we're not doing that. So then they would be like, okay, here's a pile of books. Read them and do book reports. So I was doing like my own thing in school. It was ridiculous. So I would go home and do all my own studies. And so I'd study chemistry and biology and physics and, you know, history and languages and natural sciences and medicine and everything I'd get my hands on.
Why do you think she would not let you progress like that?
Well, my family on her side says that my dad was pretty gifted too, super sharp. You know, losing him at 7, I don't recall him being, you know, incredibly intelligent. I recall him being kind, being my dad. But the family said he was sharp as a tack and that I probably got this from him. And in, to her, you know, everything was, you're just like your father, you're just like your father. When I went through the testing when I was young, I did Stanford-Binet and the Knopf-Gödel and things like that, and Rorschach, and I did a Puzzle 4 and all the more advanced tests. They came back and said to her, your kid's a genius. He's incredibly intelligent. He's off the charts. He could be a physicist. He could be anything. And I told Jason about this. I was sitting at one of these meetings in a little lobby waiting while she was in with all these doctors. There's this whole panel of PhDs and MDs or double MDs and double PhDs. And they're explaining, your son is incredibly intelligent. My God, the kid's drawing chemical formulas for things. And you know, he's drawing hydrocarbon models from memory. And she actually said to them, well, he's just got you all fooled. And this Dr. Stanley Eisen says, I'll never forget, he says, so let me get this straight. There's a whole panel of PhDs, MDs, double PhDs, some of these guys are experts in physics, psychology. He's tricked us all, but he's not a genius. And they just looked at her like, you got to be the dumbest person that ever lived. And she actually got mad at him, you know. And they said, listen, we need to put him in some kind of programs. And like, well, no, we're not doing that. And that was always her attitude.
I did not have Timogen recount that story on our most recent call, but that is exactly what he told me when I was in the same room. With that out of the way, let's go back to Timogen as he discusses his earliest days as a child.
What I'd like you to do, like just to start, is just to tell me about growing up with, your mom, I know your mom and dad split up when you were young. So just tell me about your early years.
Okay. I was born May 23rd, 1963 at St. Joseph's Hospital in Flint, Michigan, the son of Leonard Freeman and Monis Pauline Hoyler. My mother was adopted. My grandfather, her adoptive father, Carl Hoyler, was a kind and gentle man. His wife, Ethel, was the same. He was an immigrant from Germany who came here before World War II. He was a master metal spinner, so he had a very unique set of skills that were in demand and later served a lot of important functions during the war for AC. He even won several awards for some of his designs and ideas. He was an incredible engineer, well-loved by his men. And I recall his retirement party where hundreds of people showed up. And I remember some of those people telling me stories about my grandfather and his kindness. Years later, when he passed, I met more people that told me stories about his kindness, about his generosity, about all the amazing things he'd done for them. When you're a child, you don't know a lot about your family, about their life outside of the home. But I met streams of people. I remember thinking it was like Elvis Presley's funeral, just this chain of people that came to see this man when he passed. And I had no idea who he really was. But for me, he was a kind and gentle man. He was a loving man. He was a protector. Sadly, he was my protector from his own daughter. When I was young, my parents split up. I must have been probably 3 or 4 years old at the time. My father, Leonard, passed when I was only 7 years old. I don't know a lot about what really happened to him. I've never gotten an honest story from my mother. And his side of the family seems reticent to tell me exactly what happened. But I do know at the end, he was very ill. My mother claimed he had possibly cirrhosis, liver disease of some kind. I believe he was only 27 years old when he passed. I know that he died at Hurley Medical Center. I know he was on a floor where they kept patients who had severe psychosis and mental problems. And I think in this case related to his physical disease, which I still don't know the whole story regarding. But I do remember his parents, Jack and Marion Sills, telling me that he died screaming my name, saying, "I want to see Freddie. I want to see my son. I want to see Freddie. I want to see my son." And I remember weeping about that, and sometimes I still do.
You might be thinking that Temujin right now seems scripted. He admittedly speaks differently when he knows I'm recording. But I want to also say that when I was there, sitting across from him, and he told me the story, I did see the emotion in his eyes. They were clouded with grief, and it's clear, even more than 50 years later, he still misses his father.
My memories of my father were a good man. He made me laugh. He played with me. He taught me how to swim. And I believe he would have been for me everything that I wanted a father to be if he'd had the chance. I learned later from my father's family that my mother went to great lengths to keep me from him, that there was a visitation arrangement. And what my mother would do is schedule a visitation for, let's say, Sunday and tell me it was Saturday. So then when my father didn't show on Saturday, she'd tell me, "Well, I guess he doesn't love you. He doesn't want to see you." Or she'd say some other horrible thing about him. And when my father would come to get me on Sunday, he'd find that I wasn't there. And she'd say, "He didn't want to see you, so he's staying over at his friend's house for the weekend." And she did this consistently to the point where she convinced me my dad didn't love me and didn't want to see me. And then the few times I would get to see him, you know, you're young. You don't have the skills at that age to be confrontational with your father. So you're just happy to see him. But I didn't know what was really going on, and I didn't find that out until I was about 12 years old. And I just got on my bicycle one day, and I started riding all over the city of Flint. And I didn't know the exact directions to my grandparents' house, his family's house. But it was a very unique home. They had it decorated with gnomes and wagon wheels and all these beautiful garden items. And it really stood out in that area of Flint. It was a very nice, small but nice home. And inside it was same thing, very kitschy, all kinds of statues and figurines and pewter and artwork and ruby glass. They were really into collecting items, Jack and Marion were. And I found the place, and I rode my bike up into the driveway. And, of course, they hadn't seen me in some years. And they were very excited, and they invited me in, and we had this amazing visit. And I kept going back. And not long before I got locked up, I took Shelly there, so she can tell you about that. And I took her to meet Jack and Marion, and they loved her. They were just ecstatic because, you know, this is their granddaughter as far as they're concerned. We had a beautiful visit. And sadly, shortly after that, of course, I was arrested. We never got to go back. Jack and Marion actually offered to help me with my case. There's some notes in my lawyer's file that he was in contact with both of them, and they were willing to come down and secure my property for me so I wouldn't have lost everything I owned in the world. And, of course, we didn't know my lawyer was selling it all for drugs. Mr. Dean, David Dean, was selling all my things for drugs at that time. And I called Jack when I got to prison in Jackson, and he said, well, your lawyer said he took care of all your stuff. And I said, no, my lawyer sold me out, betrayed me at the trial, and he won't even tell me where my things are at or what's left. And they were very elderly at that time. I didn't, you know, want to place a lot of burdens on them.
David Dean, if you haven't gathered already, was Temujin's court-appointed attorney. He was appointed because Temujin did not have the money to pay for his own counsel. We'll discuss Mr. Dean in a later episode. That story is also wild.
When I was very young, my mother became abusive. I don't know why. If you look at my school records, I was an excellent student. I was a gifted student. In fact, I was going to Van Wy Elementary, which is in Burton, Michigan, where we had moved in, I believe, 1973. They didn't know what to do with me. So they said to my mother, look, your son is much smarter than the other kids here, and he's gone through all the work. And they used to use what were called the Scholastic Reading Association work cards back then. They're this color-coded system that came in a large box, and there would be a story and questions, and then you would write a little paper on each of these things in this series. It was supposed to take you through the entire season. And I had gone through the entire series for fourth, fifth, and sixth grade. By the time I was in fifth grade, I had nothing to do. And so they simply decided to make work for me. They would give me a book to read, set me in the back of the class, have me read the book, and then have me write a paper on the book. And that was my so-called education, was basically just educating myself. So fortunately, I loved to read. This is the time before video games and cable television. And so I would spend hours and hours and hours reading when I was young. And of course, exercising, I fell in love with the martial arts. I would read volumes on history and language. My grandfather, being a German immigrant, spoke German, so I would ask him to teach me German. And that got me into studying languages more. And my grandmother was really into natural health. So by the time I was probably 10 or 11, I was taking everything from bone meal to multivitamins. And actually looking at things in health food stores. And where the average kid might ask for toys, I would ask for a bottle of vitamin E. And my grandmother got a big kick out of that.
Temujin is into natural and holistic health. In fact, at the time of his arrest, he told me he was setting up a store to sell vitamins and natural supplements in Escanaba.
But at home, things got progressively worse, and my mother became progressively more violent. She would find more and more reasons to beat me. My bed wasn't made properly. My dresser wasn't arranged correctly. I didn't wash the dishes properly. I forgot to vacuum the living room. I didn't mow the lawn, whatever it might be. And she would give me more and more tasks and chores. At the same time, she was having affairs, which I didn't know when I was young. My sister knew, and she was a year younger than me, which is amazing. I think when you're a son, you don't want to think about your mom like that. So every night she would get dressed up and do her hair and her makeup and say she was going to play bingo. And it wasn't until I was out cruising around with some friends that I saw her car. She had a Pontiac Le Mans, very distinctive gold-colored Pontiac Le Mans. I saw it parked at the Golden Coin Lounge on the corner of Atherton and Center Road. And it was kind of a well-known bimbo bar. And then a friend of mine told me they saw my mom. This is during the disco period, of course. They saw my mom at a discotheque called The Light, which was an underground discotheque in Flint. It was in a mall in Burton, Michigan. They said, I saw your mom, and she was, you know, dancing with some guys and drinking. And I got really angry. And that person took me to some other people and said, no, it's your mom. Now, my mother worked at Myers Thrifty Acres. So a lot of people knew who she was. So they knew it was her that they saw. And so I simply went to the disco one night, and there she was. And, you know, I didn't see her doing anything, but she was furious that I was in there, even though there was no reason why I couldn't be in the place. And so I knew she was lying about playing bingo all the time, but we never talked about it. I never confronted her. But I think I began to suspect and just didn't want to think about it. The violence with her became ludicrous. Like, when I became a little more skilled in martial arts, I got good at blocking. I would spend hours having people, you know, throw shots at me So upper block, outer block, lower block, and so on. And I used to just kind of flinch when she hit me, but then I started blocking, just kind of throwing my forearms up. And that would make her angry, like, how dare you not let me hit you? So she would get more aggressive and more violent, and then it got to the point where I would just begin blocking. And she wasn't a skilled fighter, so it got to be pretty easy to block her shots. And so she switched to weapons. And it was a strap, big, heavy cut piece of kind of like belt leather that she had, folded in half, she would try to beat me with. And then I remember one day she was trying to hit me in the head with it. I hadn't done anything wrong. Anything I said to her was an insult or was talking back. If I said, yes, ma'am, what the f*** is that supposed to mean? What do you mean by that? I'm saying, yes, ma'am. And so finally one day she went to hit me in the head with the belt, and I did like this right hand block on the left side of my face and caught the belt, and I just pulled it out of her hand and I threw it down to the ground, and that infuriated her more. So then she got a wooden rod and she would start trying to beat me with the wooden rod. And eventually that escalated into a confrontation where she came back with a butcher knife, and I had a pair of nunchaku. It was very common in the 70s for people to carry nunchaku everywhere. You saw guys just on sidewalks, every school parking lot, twirling nunchucks. And I used to spend hours with them. And so I always had a pair on me, not as a weapon, and nobody ever claimed that I used them as a weapon, but because, you know, people like to watch me twirl them, and it was kind of a good way to, I guess, to get attention. It was also fun. I'd spend hours doing it.
If you haven't noticed yet, Temujin likes attention. Temujin yearns to be liked.
And I pulled them out, and I took the handles, and I knocked the knife out of her hand. And she swore then that she was going to kill me and that my father was going to kill me, even though I had never struck her, and she never claimed that I struck her. Not to the courts, not to child services, not to the foster program system. She never claimed I was physically abusive to her in any way, shape, or form. But she still said she was going to kill me, and I actually believed her. I believed she would do it. She was already literally attacking me with a butcher knife. I mean, imagine if she had hit me with this 10-inch blade. So I decided, that's it, I'm going. And prior to that, though, I had run away on several occasions, and I had been in and out of the foster care system in Flint, Michigan. This included what was then known as the REACH program, which was done through the state of Michigan. And I had a phenomenal caseworker from that program named Jody Ward. She's an amazing, incredibly kind and compassionate person who really, really cared about what was happening to me. I mean, she would literally shed tears when she saw me with all the marks and the bruises on me. And, you know, she would beg and plead with me not to go back to the home. But when you're a kid, you know, you want to go home. You just want everything to be okay. I think it's like being in an abusive relationship with a spouse. You know, they keep going back. And then everybody goes, why did you keep going back? And you start making excuses. She's under a lot of stress. She's lonely. She's sad. She's angry. Her relationship with my father's not that good. I did this wrong. I did that wrong. And I think I did that a lot. I mean, like any son, you know, I didn't have a dad, and I wanted to have a mom. And I just wanted her to love me and care about me and respect me and be my friend. And so I tried to do everything to please her, and nothing did. And but you still keep going back. And so I was also in the Victorious Christian Youth Program, which was a foster program the state used to run through a Christian services organization. And through these two programs, I was placed in multiple foster homes. Only one of them was actually a good home. That was the family called the Richardsons. They were very, very kind to me. They were very sincere Christians, and I mean that in every way. Loving, kind, forgiving, overlooked all my flaws. I did not fit in well in the home. You know, I was a bad boy from Flint. A lot of these kids were very gentle abuse victims, and they were very frail, and I think I was just too much for the family to handle. You know, I was very outspoken and, you know, boisterous, and I was out doing martial arts in the yard, kicking trees and things. And, you know, I was never accused of being abusive to a foster brother or foster sister, but I just think for them it was too much. And I was in some homes that were very abusive. I was in a home where they would beat the kids on a regular basis, and they had some sons that were twins, also incredibly abusive to the foster kids, and an older brother named. Now, they couldn't do this to me. I mean, I had fighting skill at that point. I was pretty hardened. I could take a punch. I could give a punch and a kick. And after a couple physical altercations, the older brother pulled an axe on me. This would have been 1979. And I wound up putting him down in the backyard. And he was a full-grown adult when he did this. And that scared the crap out of the family. And I had a caseworker at that time named Remus Holbrook. Good old boy from the South. He was a decent guy, but he knew what was going on. He would come out and talk to me. And I'd say, Remus, this is, they're beating the kids, you know? There was a kid there who was mentally challenged named and they would just pound this kid. I watched hit this kid with a hammer once. I mean, they were horrible, horrible people. The parents would engage in these gross sexual acts right in front of us in their living room during this mandatory TV watching time. And it was just, it was a horrible situation.
I know you think this is really horrifying, and you wonder how this could even be possible. In my lifetime, I have dealt with people who have been in foster care, and unfortunately, this story does not surprise me one bit.
And so obviously that's another reason you want to get out of that and go back home. So I couldn't wait to get out of there and go back to getting beaten at my own home in Burton. I said enough is enough. My mother and I had our last big blow up. She, you know, and she basically said, I'm going to have your stepfather kill you. He's a very big guy. I was scared of him. He's very strong, very mean. And I grabbed my skateboard and a jacket and never went back. And my mother took every single thing I had in the world, all my gifts from my father, my grandfather, every Christmas item, all my clothes, my school items, everything I had. And she literally sold it all. She owned a little junk business. And she sold everything I own, my bicycles, everything, sold it all. And my grandmother called her and said, you know, Freddie would like some of his things back. And she said, he doesn't have anything. So that was my mother. And she felt that was all, you know, justifiable. So my grandmother, Ethel, took me in. My grandfather had passed away by then. And I stayed with her until 1981 when I graduated from Flint Northern High School. Silver cords. I was a good student still. Bit of a mess, but a good student. And I joined the United States military.
On the next episode, one question causes Temujin to throw away the script, and I'll think you'll see exactly what I see. Just a man with just as much pain and just as much regret as we all have.
I'm sorry. I should have lived my life better. He set such an amazing example for me. And when he died, I was mad at the world. I forgot all those lessons. Sorry. And I'm embarrassed. And I know he wouldn't be happy. I know he'd be disappointed. I should have kept doing what I was doing, and I should have respected him and my grandmother. I don't want to diminish her role in this. She was amazing, too. She gave and gave and gave, and I forgot. I thought about myself. I was mad. I blamed all the wrong people. Blamed the world. Blamed God. I was so angry when I was young that he took my grandfather from me. I gave up on faith. I think I gave up on people. I gave up on caring. Sorry, Jason.
You don't have to apologize, man. Like this is what I
never talk about this stuff. Not even to Paula.
This is what I want people to understand about you, though. Because, you know, the person that I believe that I know is what you're giving me right now. And the person that I want Whitmer to know is the person you're giving me right now. And the person that and anybody else that's big that's going to do this case needs to know this person, because this person right here, the one that's being absolutely vulnerable, honest, and fully, fully raw, getting into all of this stuff that you've gone through and understanding, like, it's okay to have a little bit of pain, or like a lot of pain, because you recognize, like, you don't have to convince me you didn't kill Scott. I know you didn't do that.
I know.
But I do know, like, there were things that happened when you were younger that, like, pushed you into a place where people thought that you did, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so, like, that's what, like, my goal right now is to get to show people, like, you know, like, we all do things that we are not proud of. And it all, like, generally comes from a place of pain at first. Inconceivable, the story of Temujin Kinsu, is written, researched, produced, and edited by Earcult LLC. That's me, Jason Usry. Carly Fulham is my co-producer and partner in all important things. Special thanks to both Paula and Temujin Kinsu, along with many others, for providing case materials for this podcast. Thanks to Joy Marie Mann for additional recordings. Check out her book,
my friend Timogen, serving life, changing lives, at neweraincj.org. Join the Inconceivable Facebook group or show your support on patreon.com/santamaybe, where all ear cult content is currently available. Music and atmospheres are licensed royalty-free through Epidemic Sound, Universal Music for Creators, Soundstripe, Pond 5, and others. All examinations and opinions in this podcast are solely those of our contributors and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Ear Cult LLC. All editorial opinions are made solely by Ear Cult LLC. Two life sentences, one search for truth. This is Inconceivable, the story of Timogen Kinsu.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.